Okay, so good afternoon. After apparently the projector just decided to not project the laptop cable or the PC in the podium, which is usually my backup plan. Now we have started. I'm going to probably cut a few things I was planning on talking about today to try to keep us on track. So last time we talked about the TLB. This was a cache for page table entries. It's also the subject of the homework due next week. So we look up by the virtual page number, then this replaces, when it's the cache is successful, the whole page table lookup, meaning that if we've done the page table lookup for that virtual page number recently in the past, it should be in our TLB, and we won't have to go through checking each page table at each level. This cache is organized in the same kind of way as the set associative caches we saw for data, except that rather than our blocks containing bytes of data, our blocks contain page table entries. And rather than looking up with the full address, we just look up with the virtual page number because, well, everything in that virtual page, you know, uses the same page table entry. Then we started talking about creating processes and changing what program is running. And we learned that the sort of traditional Unix way of doing this, which is not what every OS does, so like Windows does these two things with one function, is that we have one function for creating a new process, and that function is called fork. And it sort of splits our process into two identical processes by copying the original. And then we have a separate function called exec, which keeps the current process here, so we have the same process ID, and as we'll learn later today, the same files. And we just load a different program into it, replacing the current memory. And in lab yesterday, you combine these two to actually run some other programs while waiting for them to finish. Because if we just exec, then you'd run the other programs, and those programs would exit, and you're not running anymore. But since we fork and exec, we get to keep running those programs. We get to run those programs, and you keep running afterwards because you have a separate process that didn't get replaced. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so there's one thing I'd like to talk about that sort of kind of combines TLBs and our multiple processes that we kind of skipped over when we talked about TLBs, and that's how do we deal with a TLB when we change from one process to another? So when we change page tables, everything that's cached in our TLB no longer makes sense because if we were running, say, ls, and now we're running our shell, those programs have different page tables. So the TLB entries for ls, we shouldn't keep using them for the shell. And with normal caches, this is not something that software needs to worry about, but TLBs generally make a different decision here. And there's kind of two solutions to this. So one is that we can invalidate all the TLB entries when we change processes. And the hardware can implement this by making it so when you change the page table base register, it clears all the TLB entries. Another option that some processors do that can be more efficient is that we can have, in addition to our tag information in our TLB, we can have a process ID. So the OS will tell the hardware what the process ID is, and that means that the TLB can cache page table entries from different processes and can figure out, you know, whether they're currently useful or not. And this means that we don't have to clear the TLB when we're switching from one process to another. We can still keep those entries in case we switch back to that process. Yes?
Is the TLB stored in memory, or is it somewhere close to the processor?
The question is, where is the TLB stored? The TLB is stored in the processor. It's going to be, we want it to be in storage that's really fast. So it's going to be something kind of similar to how registers are stored. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? So this is for changing from one process to another. The same issues occur when we update a page table entry that might be in our TLB. So even if we're running the same program, let's say the OS wants to change where your stack is stored in memory. We can update the page table to change that, but we also need to make sure the TLB stays in sync. And unlike normal caches, the hardware won't do this for us. So the OS needs to do a bit of work to tell the processor about this. And there's two common approaches to doing that. So one is that we can have a special instruction. So on x86, there's this invalid invalidate page instruction, which of course x86 decided they couldn't write out for doing that, or we could just do the operation that triggers clearing the whole TLB, though obviously that's going to be a lot slower because we'll have a lot of cache misses. So questions about this sort of, this idea that when we edit our page tables, unlike what we saw with normal caches, the hardware won't keep them in sync for us because it doesn't keep track of the information to do that. So they made the decision that the OS needs to help the hardware and tell the hardware, hey, I'm changing page tables, you know, give them the hardware enough information to make sure the TLB doesn't get out of sync. Questions? Yes. Okay. So we were going through our process management functions, and the one we didn't like fully cover was wait PID. And apparently, there we go. Wait PID, or wait, but you use that in the lab, and it's definitely the simpler than fork and exec. So I'm going to just kind of gloss over that, other than to kind of mention our reiterate our common pattern. So commonly, we'll have this pattern where if we want to run a program and wait for it to finish, we'll fork to copy our current program. And in the child process, we'll use exec. And in the parent process, we'll use wait PID to wait for that process to finish. And wait PID will let us collect the exit status of that process to do something with later. We can kind of visualize what happens here as maybe this version, that our parent process, it runs after fork and runs wait PID, our child process runs exec, runs this other program until that program exits, and wait PID waits for that exit to happen. And we could also do this with running multiple programs. So if I want to run two different programs at the same time, I can do that. I can fork twice, make two child processes, and I can wait for each of them separately, and that will work. Yes? So question, what happens if the child exits before wait PID is called? So the way wait PID works is that when a program exits, wait PID will still return the information about how it exited, even if it already exited before. So if it hasn't finished, it waits for it. If it has finished, it just returns, and the OS is going to keep around that exit status until you call wait PID. If you never call wait PID, then the OS is going to be keeping around that exit status until it knows you won't, probably because your program exited. Does that answer your question? Yes. So the question is, do I need to call wait PID? So if you don't do some form of waiting, the OS is going to be keeping in memory the status that it's waiting for you to collect, unless you do something to deal with that. So I would suggest calling wait PID unless, you know, the special case where you maybe that you wouldn't make sense if after you run the child process you just exit. But if you're otherwise you're gonna, it's kind of like a little memory leak. Does that answer your question? Can I go over the definition of a process? So a process, do I have that diagram? I do not have that diagram. So a process, we had threads, which are that notion of we have our own program counter and our own registers, and it looks like we have a processor to ourselves and memory, right? So it was that kind of the simulated processor and the simulated memory. We learned that we use context switches to have that simulated processor, even if we didn't actually have that many processors. And we use page tables to simulate having the whole memory, even if we didn't really have that. So a process is the combination of those two things. And as we'll learn about later today, that we talked about like one thread so far, a process can have multiple threads, kind of like multiple virtual processors that share some common memory. that, and there's also, as we'll see later, associated with processes, the files you have open, and other information like that.
So a process is just like the illusion of having its own computer?
So the question is, the process is the illusion of having its own computer? Yes, that's a good way of thinking about it, is that it's kind of a virtual computer that your programs get, and it has an interface that's designed to be like nice to write programs for. Other questions? Yeah. What exactly is a shell? So a shell is a program that allows users to run other programs. Does that answer your question? And that is indeed what we'll talk about next. So that's what I have a slide for. Other questions before I move on to this? So the question is, why would I run everything in the parent process? Why would I do this fork? Why didn't I just exec right away? And the issue is that if I want to run anything after I run this program, I can't do that if I don't fork. Because when I exec this child process, it's just going to exit. So if I didn't exec, I'm not running anymore. And nothing's running, in fact. So for example, with your MySystem function in the lab, because you forked is the only reason why you could have code that runs after the command runs. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so let's do a little exercise about fork and exec before we move on to shells. So here I have a loop which is we're execing bin echo, and the way echo works is if I run echo arg, it prints out arg and a new line. It's just a built-in program that prints out its arguments. And my question is, what outputs are possible here? Give a little time to look at that. And I would find it helpful to kind of draw out this diagram that we. We have two forks, so we have like one thread that keeps running our parent, and we make two child processes because that loop runs twice, at least two. Questions, or who would like some more time? Okay, a bunch of people. Okay. I guess it looks like people still need more time. Okay, so who thinks the answer is A, B, C, D, E, okay, F? Okay, so most people got E, and that matches what I get. So what happens here is when I equals 0, we fork a child process, and in that child process, PIDs of 0 is 0. And the parent, PIDs of 0, is the new child's process ID. Because remember, fork returns 0 to indicate you're in the child. The idea being that if you want to know your new PID, call get PID. But you can't do that in the parent, obviously, to get the PID of the child, so fork needs to return it in the other case. And there, we're going to run echo L1. Then when I equals 1 in our parent, well, we get to I equals 1, first of all, because PIDs of 0 is not 0, so we skip that whole if statement and go to the next iteration of the loop and fork again. And in the second child process, we run echo L2. And when we exec echo, that replaces the process. So we're not going to do any more work. So we don't need to worry about, for example, our first child process after it runs echo L1. It can't do anything more. It's going to exec. So it's not going to run echo L2, so we won't get the B output based on that. And then what we do here is we wait for both of the processes. So we just don't return until they're all done doing their work of echoing things. Some questions on how I figure that out? Yes. Question, if I wanted to make only A possible and not C, is there a way I can make that happen? Absolutely. And the easiest way would be to wait before, call wait PID before I fork the second time. Does that answer your question? Yes.
So in the case of C, when it gets to wait bit, the child process for L2 is going to return first, but because it's waiting for L1, it's going to keep waiting until it has to take L1, and it's going to take L1.
So the question is, when it for C to happen, how does that work with the waits? So remember that the way wait PID and wait work are that you can wait for something that's already finished. So when the echoes finish is unrelated to the order you wait for them, just because, you know, if they already finished, wait's going to return. If they haven't finished, wait will wait for them to finish and then return. But this means that if you call wait after it finish, it's not a problem. And that, in fact, that, you know, probably, yeah, in case C, you probably would end up doing that, depending on exactly what the timing looks like. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so we're going to talk a little about things that shells do and how they do them. So the shell is the program that allows you to run programs. You're probably most familiar with the command line version of the shell. But I would say that there are also graphical shells. So like the Finder in OS X or the Windows Explorer, those are shells because they allow you to run programs. They just have a graphical interface instead of a command line interface. And the shell has some features that you know, are interesting. So one is that we saw that when we ran exec, we had to pass the path to a program, so it has to find that. And another feature the shell has are these redirection features, these features where we can run a program and send its output to somewhere else, or have its input come from somewhere else. That's what those redirection operators do. So backslash program to output.txt makes the program's output go to output.txt instead of your terminal. Or we can have one program's output go into another program. So we're going to talk about how does that work? How can we run a program that way? Because there wasn't any argument to exec to make this happen. So what are we going to do that? And to understand how this works, we need to think about how files work. And we've seen file descriptors before. So in the Unix model, every process has an array of files. And we have these file descriptors, which are like the file descriptors you've seen for sockets, which are indexes into this array. So we just have an array of pointers to information about open files. And an open file could be a terminal, it could be a socket, could be a regular file on disk, could be a pipe, which we'll learn about later. And this is what our system calls that read and write are going to use, are going to use these indexes into this array. That's part of the info about your process that the kernel is keeping track of. And you might say, okay, if this is how all the files work, not just my sockets, how does like standard in work? How do we know what standard in is or standard out? How does printf know where to go? Right? How does it know which file to use? And what Unix has decided to do is they just have a convention. 0 is input, standard in, 1 is standard out, 2 is standard error. So printf just hard codes, we're gonna use file descriptor 1. And scanf hard codes, we're gonna use file descriptor 0. And if you don't like typing these numbers, POSIX and Unix has these constants predefined in unix-standard.h. So that sounds reasonable, but you might have this bit of a problem that when we get file descriptors, like we can call open and get a file descriptor or call socket or some other functions to get file descriptors, we don't get to choose what that number is. So how do we make it so that it's going to be 1. And we want to be able to do that because, well, we want to implement sending the output somewhere else, like to a file or to another program, instead of where it was before. But it seems like open and other things like that, they don't give us that choice, it seems like. So how do we do that? We'll talk about that later. Yes? So the question is, since the file descriptor is an integer, does that mean there's a maximum number of files you can have in a computer? So there is a maximum number. I don't think that's because it's an integer versus something else, because even if it was a pointer, there's only so many pointer values, right? But there is a limit, yes, and often that limit is maybe smaller than you would hope it would be, but there's also sort of an inherent limit in that you only have so much memory and the OS would have to track all the files. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
Is this file array always around, or is it unique per process so that they can know which file descriptors they have access to?
So the question is, this file array always around, or is it unique per process? So this is part of the information about a process that the OS will track. So every process is going to have their own list of open files. So if we think of, like when we do exec, there's going to be one of the things that we're not changing is that list of open files. It's going to turn out. And when we fork, we're going to copy the list because it's going to be part of the process's information. So something a bit weird about this list is that this is a list of pointers to the files that we have open. So this means that when we copy them with fork, we get two pointers to the same file. That makes sense, right? Because if we fork a process and we both print to the same terminal, we should have pointers to the same thing. This means that some other things maybe don't work the way you might think. So close closes the file descriptor, and it's basically equivalent to setting that entry of your array to null. And then the OS will make sure we don't leak memory, but it basically just sets that entry of the array to null. And this means that, for example, if I'm running in my shell and I close standard out, that doesn't mean my shell can't print the standard out, because I only closed my file descriptor. I didn't close the shells, even though they point to the same place. So how are we going to do this redirection operation? And the key way we're going to do it is that when we do exec, there's a list of open files associated with our process, which doesn't change. So to implement that redirection operation, we just need to make sure standard out now goes somewhere else before we call exec. Make sure file descriptor 1 points to a different place. So what we'll do is we'll fork. Fork is going to make a copy of our list of file descriptors. And these file descriptors, initially, are going to point to the same thing, probably our terminal. And if we want to, say, redirect the output, we're just going to change that file descriptor to point somewhere else in the child process, but not the parent process. And then we exec, and those aren't going to change. So the program's going to run, and its output is not going to go to where it went before, but to some other place. So the sort of pattern we'll have is that we'll do some extra work before we exec in the child process, and that will allow us to set up the environment for that process, for that program we're running. And this kind of idea is why I think Unix likes the fork and exec model, because rather than having exec like take extra arguments to specify where do you want this program's output to be, we just use the existing APIs to change what files we have open, and we can solve the problem that way rather than making the exec function more complicated. So the question we might have is, how do I make file descriptor 1 be something different? Because I mentioned when I open a file, it goes to the same place it was before. And we have a special call for that, which is dupe2. And dupe2 is a system call, typically a system call, and it just assigns one file descriptor to another. So that makes them both point to the same place. So we can use this dupe2 to make a file descriptor we've opened, which has some big number, have the number for standard out, which would happen to be the constant 1. And it's just in the kernel going to do this assignment plus some stuff to make sure we don't leak memory. So for example, here's some code where in my current process, I open a new file, output.txt, and I change standard out to go to it. And that means that after I do this, if I printf, it goes to that output file instead of where standard out was before, probably my terminal. So I can use code like this where I use this dupe2 operation to change where a file goes to make it go to a different place. Even though it's the same file descriptor, it's still standard out. And this means that if I exec a program after this, its output would also go to output.txt because it's going to keep the same standard out that I have. Questions about our example of redirecting? Okay. So we have these operations for going files. So we have a little exercise on this. Here. So here I have a program. Oh, and I should mention write, the way write works is write, takes a file descriptor, a buffer, and a size of that buffer. You may have seen this when you did sockets. So a file descriptor, that's an index into that list of files that we have open, a buffer, and the size of that buffer. Who would like some more time? Okay, a bunch of people. Okay, so let's start with, so who thinks the answer is A? B? Some people. C? D? E? No clue? Okay, so we have a big split and no clue. So let me go through how I figure this out. So when we start here, when we start out, initially, standard out goes to probably our terminal, and the other two files aren't open. Then we call this open call here. That's going to mean fd goes to output.txt. And output.txt, if we're going to keep track of what's in there, has a, because we just wrote to output.txt. Because that's where it currently goes. Then I do this dupe to of standard out to number 100. And dupe to is source destination. So now 100 points the same place standard out points, which means 100 now goes to the terminal. Then we do dupe to of fd to standard out. So now instead of standard out pointing to the terminal, it points to output.txt. So I just did these two dupe twos. So now I see the standard out and fd both point to the same place, output.txt. And 100 saved our old copy of the terminal. So you could potentially print to the terminal again. Then I print a standard out. Well, that goes to output.txt now, so that's going to be a B. Then I print to FD, that goes to output.txt, so that's going to be a C. Then I close FD. And close, remember, just assigns that entry to not point to anything. So now what all that changes is output.txt points to null. But standard out still points to output.txt because we didn't change that. Close just changes that file descriptor. It doesn't change anything else, which points to the same one. So then I write to standard out, I write a D. That's going to go to output.txt. And then I write an E to 100. That's going to go to the terminal. So I get answer B. Some questions on how I figure that out? Yes, back there. Yeah, dupe to a source destination, so.
So why wouldn't like the first dupe to call set standard out to point
So, sorry. The question is, why would if it's Duke 2 source destination, why wouldn't the first call chain standard out? Maybe I should say it as Duke 2 is old and new is what changes. So the Duke 2 call only changes the file descriptor of its second argument.
Okay.
Does that answer your question? Yes.
What does 100
represent? I just chose a number that I hope wasn't being used. And you can do that. You can just choose a number and hope it's not being used and that it's within the bounds of the array the OS is maintaining.
Wait, so where does the terminal come from when you said 100?
Where did I say the terminal came from? So my assumption is when we started out, standard out went to a terminal. And that's where it came from. Does that answer your question? Yes, back there. Yes, you. Question is, why when I changed standard out to point somewhere else, did 100 not change? So the way I think about it is each of the entries in our list of file descriptors points to a file, and dupe2 makes it point to the same file it currently points to, but we don't have any extra indirection. So they always point to a file. So this first operation makes 100 point to the terminal file, and that's all it points to. It doesn't point to standard out and then to the terminal. It points to the terminal. So when we change standard out later on, that doesn't affect that new pointer. Does that answer your question?
So if it had pointed to FB before, when FB pointed to output.txt, if it had pointed to FB instead, it would also point to output.txt.
So the question is, if standard out already pointed to output.txt, when I did this operation here, would 100 also point to output.txt? Yes. Other questions? Yes, over there.
So since you closed FD, if you were to write after that to FD, it would not work, correct?
So question, if I wrote after I closed FD to FD, it would not work? Yes. And if you check the return value of write, it would return -1, indicating an error.
And so you can still write to output.txt using standard out?
But question is, I could still write to output.txt using standard out? Yes. Okay. Other questions? Yeah. Is there a way to see if a file descriptor is already closed? You can try to read or write from it. Or probably fstat, which is get information about it. Yes, back there.
Can you loop through like FD after it's closed?
Can I dupe to FD after it's closed? I do not know what dupe to does if the old file descriptor is closed. I would assume it doesn't work very well. So question, if it was the new file descriptor? So are you asking if I could do like dupe 2 of FD to something here? Or are you asking if I could...
Other way around.
Oh, if I could dupe 2 something to FD? Yes, I could absolutely do that. In which case, we'd replace this null here to point to something else. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so in our last few minutes, which I hope to have not been our last few minutes, but we'll be able, there's one other special kind of files that's relevant for doing this redirection, which is pipes. So pipes are a special kind of file where there's two ends of a pipe, and if you write in one end, you can read from the other. And this is useful if you want to run a program like you'll need to do in the fork homework that's coming up and read its output. So this gives you a special file you can use to do that. You set up a pipe, it writes to the pipe file, you can read from that file and get its output. So the way this kind of works is you call this pipe function with an array of two file descriptors, and one of them's a write file descriptor, one of them's a read file descriptor. And after this is set up, you can write from one and read from another. And the most common way this might be used is, let's say I want to implement this pipeline here. So I'm running ls and sending its output through grep. And ls is a program that lists the files. Grep is a program that searches for a particular string. So this command will print all the files in a directory that have foo in their name. And how do we run this? Well, we run ls, but we change its standard out to be the right end of the pipe. Pipe that we set up, and we change grep standard in to be the read end of the pipe. So rather than ls writing to the terminal, it writes to this pipe. And rather than grep reading from the terminal, it reads from this pipe. So the output goes from one to the other. And I have sort of a diagram on what that looks like here. So let's say pipe will give us two file descriptors, and we're going to doing some dupe to operations to make it so both of them sort of are connected to each other. So questions on this idea of this special pipe file? Okay, so before I finish up, our next topic is going to be about threads. And we have a lab next week, which is kind of about synchronization through an example of a group activity. That means that there's only in-person checkoff. If you can't do that for some reason, you should talk to me, but just so you're aware. And next time, we'll talk a bunch about threads.